Second case on our docket was Charter Oak versus Swanigan. That case was removed from the docket and rescheduled. So we will move on to the third case, which is Corey Nelson Turner versus State of Texas. If the clerk will please announce counsel for the parties.
May I please report Mr. Larry Moore to argue for appellant and Ms. Helena Harvey to argue for the case.
All right, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please report?
Dr. Butcher and I represent Mr. Turner. It is the first time either one of us have had the opportunity to be in the court for some time, and we appreciate that opportunity. Were he not ill today, we'd probably be switching seats right now, but I will argue on behalf of Mr. Turner. There are 9 points of error in the brief, and I'm not going to attempt to argue all those points. I do want to touch on a couple of them in response to some things that were raised in the state's brief. And the first one is the first point error dealing with the right to public trial and the exclusion of the defendant's family from the courtroom during the voir dire proceedings. It's obvious from the record in the case that the court understood the request that I made. He broaches the subject on the record first. There was an off-the-record discussion. You can tell by the way that he says it, because the first thing that he says, it's my understanding that the defense wishes to have the family members present during the jury selection. That's the whole issue. We wanted the family, at least three of the family members, to be present during the jury selection, and he wouldn't make accommodation to do that. I indicated to the court in response to his inquiry that I think the way that I worded it, that his wife and his brother are here, and I've asked him to be here today for the express purpose to see if anybody on the panel knows them. I also know that his father-in-law is here. I think the state misstates my request in that regard. That's why I said I wanted him up there. That's not why I said I wanted him in the courtroom. It's obvious after the court proffered his alternative that I could bring them into the courtroom and introduce them to the veneer. I told him, fine, I understand that, and we'll do that. But I still object to the fact that they're not allowed to be present in the courtroom. I got part of what I wanted by doing it in that way. I noticed in preparing for this argument that I made a misstatement in the brief. I indicate that the point at which I asked them to, the wife and the brother, to be brought into the courtroom was in volume 4, page 35. That's incorrect. It was volume 5, page 35. And I will provide a correct citation by letter brief. When I asked that the wife and the brother be brought in, who got brought in was the wife and the father-in-law. The brother wasn't brought in, and I didn't know why until sometime later.
And so the record doesn't explain anything about where the brother was?
No, not at all. It's not in the record.
Okay.
As I indicated, by allowing me to bring them in, I got part of what I wanted. I mean, I got the opportunity to ask the veneerman if anybody recognized the father-in-law and the wife. What I didn't get was the converse of that, the opportunity to ask them, do you recognize anybody on the panel? What I didn't get was the opportunity to know whether or not any of the veneermen were mistaken or dishonest or untruthful or forgetful about the fact that they knew them. What I didn't get was their presence and their support in the courtroom for the defendant, and what I didn't get was their input or response as to any of the particular veneermen that we might impanel on the jury. And those are just the losses that we sustained. They have their own independent right to be there. There was no lawful basis to exclude those persons from the courtroom. That's the whole reason in the brief we analogized this point of error to a Batson-type problem, because they've got their own independent right to be present. How in the world can that family have any confidence in the process, in the fairness of his trial? How do they know that I'm not a blithering idiot up there not doing what I'm supposed to do? How do they know that I'm not complicit with the state in getting their loved one convicted? They have their own independent right, and the Supreme Court recognizes that, and that's why they say this is a structural error, because it may be impossible. They tell us in Waller and Presley, it may be impossible to point to a specific harm that befalls the particular defendant, because you can't, but you can't calculate it that way. The harmless error analysis is not suited to deal with that, because the harm exceeds beyond the defendant, and it goes to the persons that are excised from the courtroom and to the public as a whole. The whole rationale behind Presley and Waller and the cases dealing with public trial is essentially that access by the public is what is integral to ensuring the fairness of these proceedings. That access to the public is what gives us confidence that the judge and the jury are going to perform their responsibilities in the way that they're supposed to. That the people that are sworn to tell the truth do so and don't perjure themselves. And so the court tells us that, you know, the only way that you can overcome that, the only way that you can overcome their right to be present, is if there is a single overriding interest that the court identifies as the reason why that person should be excluded from the courtroom. That wasn't done. There's a four-point litany that's set out in Waller and Presley as to the things that the court must do in order to allow or for it to be permissible to exclude these people. They have to identify that overriding interest. They have to demonstrate that the closure was no broader than necessary to accomplish that interest. They have to indicate that they have, they have to show that he considered reasonable alternatives to the closure, any other reasonable alternative might exist, and they have to articulate specific findings of fact that demonstrate that the closure was no greater than was absolutely necessary to accomplish that purpose. In Presley, they suggest a number of different ways the court may accommodate this. You know, the way that I asked for was to seat some of the veneer in the jury box. You know, the judge, I think it's in the record in regard to the jury list, you'll see, which is a part of the record, but it's sealed. The court called an excessive number of jurors. It was 60 to 65 jurors. I don't remember the exact number. And it completely filled the courtroom. And he did that for the express purpose of the issues in the case. He knew that there was going to be some jurors that would not qualify. And he's correct. 28 people ended up disqualifying from service or were agreed to be excused. But the court goes further and said it doesn't turn on the remedy that I suggest. The remedy, you know, the court has the obligation to consider other accommodations on its own. They suggest, you know, reserving one or more rows in the courtroom for the public, dividing the jury panel in half in order to accomplish making room in the courtroom. Divide the panel and do it in two parts. And instruct the jurors not to engage or contact the audience members. You know, I have done this a number of different ways. I've had cases where they've been transferred to a larger courtroom for purposes to pick the jury. I've had cases where we picked the jury in the central jury room of the county because it was the biggest courtroom in the thing. The Code of Criminal Procedure in Article 3402 specifically sets out a process that if you exhaust the veneer, you summon talesmen and you inquire of them separately. There are a number of different ways that the court could accommodate this request to allow the family to be present for voir dire, and he chose to not do so. And it was all a matter of constraint. In my opinion, it was concern for the convenience of the court and the time that would be involved as opposed to the rights of the particular defendant and the rights of his family. You know, he allowed students and assistant DAs to sit in the jury box. But my family's sitting out on the bench outside because the court would not accommodate them. He indicates in the pretrial hearing, you know, he has concerns about this trial running over into the next week because he had a judicial conference to attend, and sure enough, that's what happened. And another judge had to come in and take the verdict. But the court has that obligation to accommodate that request, and he did not do so. You know, the court talks about, in Presley, these protections are so fundamental and so well settled that that case was disposed in a per curiam opinion, and it was disposed under a summary disposition. Two of the judges, you know, in the dissent talked to that issue, but seven of them agreed that this issue was so settled by the time of Presley in January of 2010 there wasn't even any need to, you know, to brief it and go further.
But Mr. Moore, I think the problem the state raises is, was this aspect of your objection really brought to the court's attention? Because the dialogue between the two, to me, sounds like the trial court thought it had addressed the question as to the defense's right to have the potential panel members observe and see who family members were, as opposed to the public nature of...
Well, I understand what the court's saying, but that does, if you look at the record, following immediately on him saying, you know, this is what I will allow you to do, and say, okay, I will do that way. I said, but I object to them not being allowed to be in for voir dire. How can he possibly not understand? Matter of fact, he says, I understand. He understood the nature of the objection, and he didn't comply with it. I mean, it's very simple.
Mr. Moore, how do you respond to the state's argument that the case should be remanded for trial court findings satisfaction of the Waller?
Because I don't think that it's necessary. I think it's on the record, the reason the judge did it, because there wasn't room in the courtroom. He said every room was full, every chair was full. He brought in extra seats for the panel. It's interesting, you know, that they referenced the Stedman case and the abatement in the Stedman case. That case was argued in the Court of Appeals, in the Court of Criminal Appeals in October. And a large part of that argument dealt with the remand to the court for the abatement hearing. The court provided findings of fact, and the argument in the Court of Criminal Appeals is, okay, what do we do now? What the judge did is he gave them a description or a summary of the considerations that he made, but there was nothing in the record before the court that substantiated any of that. He talked about courtroom security concerns and things like that. And there was absolutely nothing in the record of the case. So if the abatement is for purposes of making the judge make findings, do we do that? Does he impanel a hearing? Does he allow testimony on that issue? Or does he simply, you know, put out those things that were in his mind that are not reflected or supported by any evidence or facts in the record? And that's the problem. I don't think that it's necessary based on the express statements that the court makes in regard to the issue. I would like to touch briefly on the points of error dealing with the testimony of Patience Castillo, points of error 2, 3, and 4, and I want to talk to the preservation of error issue. The state indicates that we forfeited that complaint by failing to attack all the independent grounds for the trial court's ruling. It's our belief that the points of error are sufficient to encompass the 403 issue. The points dealt with the failure of the court to admit that testimony, both as to the specific acts and as to her opinion testimony, and it also goes to the failure to the court to strike the testimony of Mr. Castillo regarding his opinion or his statement that he had never seen the victim engage in any violent acts before. You know, Marsh indicates that we have to attack all independent grounds, and a lot of the discussion in Marsh deals with issues that are not properly preserved for the court because they're not properly briefed, and a large part of the brief on that point of error deals with the 403 balancing case. The Mozon case that we cite on pages 17 through 19 of the brief and discuss at length is strictly a 403 case. That's the whole issue that PDR was grounded on. What is the appropriate consideration, the factors to be balanced, and so forth. The discussion of Casey versus State on 20 through 21 of the brief, it's a 403 discussion. We actually set out that portion of the opinion in Casey dealing with the factors that the court is to consider and to balance in making that 403 determination. And in both Casey and Mozon, they talk about the need for the evidence. The big problem in this case is the need for that evidence was exacerbated by the state's conduct in eliciting the testimony from Mr. Castillo that he had never seen the guy be violent before, when they knew about Patience Peters. As you see, when I call her as a witness, the first thing that happened is the prosecutor approached. It's the same day that Castillo testified, And the minute I call her, they approach the court and say, we need to go outside the presence of the jury and have a hearing because we think that he is going to try to go into these prior acts. So they elicit that testimony, knowing that there is that possible testimony from Patience Castillo that exists out there. This isn't something I pulled out of my hat. They knew about it. And then they turn around and they want the benefit of excluding that testimony that's offered in rebuttal. The cases clearly say that her opinion as to his propensity to violence is admissible on his character conformity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Ms. Faulkner.
May it please the court. It's undisputed in this case that the right to public trial does apply to the voir dire proceedings in this case, and that the trial court, if it's going to exclude certain members or close the courtroom, must specifically articulate certain considerations set out in Presley and Waller. And among those, you know, the court must consider reasonable accommodations. And here we don't have very, if any, specific findings required by Waller and Presley. The trial court appears to have considered the suggestion that some veneer members be allowed to sit in the jury box and appears to have rejected that suggestion. And I don't mean to suggest that the case law does say that neither party has an obligation to make recommendations for alternative accommodations. I don't mean to imply that he had any burden, but the court did consider that and reject it. With regard to the state's waiver argument, it's a matter of interpretation of what the record reflects, and the state argues that in context of the entire exchange, appellant's objection to the family members not being allowed to remain in the courtroom during the voir dire proceedings was not sufficient to apprise the trial court that appellant was invoking his Sixth Amendment right to a public trial. Appellant's counsel stated that he had requested appellant's wife and brother and father-in-law to be here for the express purpose to see if anybody on the panel knows them. The court noted that everyone agreed that the courtroom was full. And the court denied the request, but said, I'll allow you to bring these family members in for purposes of introduction. Defense counsel said, I'll do it that way, and then stated, but I object to the court not making arrangements for the family members to be in the courtroom. State's argument is that in context, there's no mention of a denial of a public trial. And that in the context of this exchange, the trial court could have viewed that second objection as simply a re-urging of the trial court's denial of the request to have the family members in the courtroom for the express purpose of determining whether any veneer members knew them.
So it is the state's position that the right to a public trial is a waivable right as opposed to a fundamental.
There are cases cited in the state's brief that hold that the right to a public trial must be exerted or it's waived. And so in this case, if appellant's objection at the trial was not sufficient, I'm arguing in the context of the exchange in this case, to apprise the trial court that he was asserting a denial of the right to a public trial, if it wasn't sufficient, then his public trial complaint is waived. Well, the request was for the family members to remain in the courtroom during the voir dire proceedings. The court, I think, in an attempt to make an accommodation, there was no room for the family members, said, okay, you want to see if any veneer members know the family? I'll allow you to bring them in for purposes of introduction. And I think the trial court thought that that would satisfy the request. Defense counsel says, I'm sorry. From
the express purpose of me bringing the NDA.
Right. He says, Judge, his wife and his brother are here, and I've asked them to be here today for the express purpose to see if anybody on the panel knows him. Knows them. Right. And if that is the request, then that's a more limited interpretation. If all he's requesting is for the veneer members to be able to see the family, then that certainly would not, if all he's requesting is that, then that certainly wouldn't articulate a public trial.
His point is, and I was asking for something different and more in my last exchange with the court, I was not reiterating what I had just asked for because he had just asked. Go ahead.
Okay. I think that the interpretation can also be that we want them to sit in here in the courtroom. We want them here. They asked for veneer members to be seated in the jury box in order to make room for the family members. The court said you can bring them in for purposes of introductions. He says, okay, we'll do it that way, and I think you can read that second objection as being, but we still object to the family members not being in here, so that I think that the trial court could interpret that second objection as just a re-urging of the initial request for the family members to be in the courtroom for the express purpose of allowing the veneer members to see if they knew any of the family members. Moving on, this, like I said, the state does not dispute that the trial court did not, specifically articulate its reasoning as required by Waller and by Presley. There are a few things we can infer. The court considered it had a crowded courtroom. It brought in extra chairs. I think that we can infer that the appellant's counsel suggested putting some of the veneer members in the jury box, and the court denied that. I think he considered that, even if it's not expressed, the reasons why that was rejected. And that is why, if the court finds that appellant properly preserved his public trial complaint, that's why the state is requesting that the court abate this appeal so that the trial court can articulate any of the considerations that it had when it denied the request. If you find that there was a request or an objection sufficient to preserve the public trial complaint. In Stedman, the state did request that the appeal be abated because the court had not made the findings required by Waller and by Presley.
Defense counsel raised an issue on how the abatement hearing would be handled. What is the state's position in that regard as far as calling witnesses? What type of hearing?
The state's position is that an abatement could be handled no hearing would be required, that the trial court on abatement could articulate findings for the record in writing or hold a hearing and have the parties present and have a court reporter present, but that the trial court would simply articulate what, if any, considerations, what the factors were in compliance with Waller and Presley. And, the abatement was part of the issue, I agree, in Stedman. And if the court gets to the point of considering abatement, certainly I think that when the Stedman case comes out from the Court of Criminal Appeals, it will provide guidance of whether an abatement would be proper. state's position is that an abatement would be proper under Rule 44.4 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure. The findings were required in the same way that cases have been abated when we don't have the hearings and findings required by Batson or specific findings on the voluntariness of a confession, those types of things. Here, these findings are required. I recognize that there are other cases where the courts reverse because there weren't findings, but it doesn't appear, there's nothing in those cases to indicate that there was a request for abatement and that request was rejected. Just to touch briefly on the point of error regarding Patience Castillo, while appellant does, with regard to the forfeiture argument of the state, while appellant does reference cases, Mozon and other cases that cite Rule 403 or discuss Rule 403, and he does set forth some of the considerations in general that the law requires for the balancing test under Rule 403, he hasn't raised a specific point of error challenging the trial court's express exclusion of Ms. Castillo's testimony under Rule 403. And he hasn't presented any argument applying the facts of this case and why her testimony should not have been excluded under Rule 403. In other words, he hasn't applied the Rule 403 factors to this case and showed why the trial court abused its discretion. So the state's position is that he has not challenged the Rule 403 exclusion of the evidence, and therefore he should be held to have forfeited that complaint. Unless the court has any further questions, the state would pray that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
All right, thank you, Ms. Faulkner. Mr. Moore, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
On the preservation of error issue in regard to the public trial matter, one of the cases that they cite is the Heidelberg case, and in the dissent in that case, Judge Johnson points to the Langston case that invokes the language from the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion in Langston that kind of sets out the degree of specificity that's required. And in Langston, Judge Benavides said there is no magic language that's required. Plain English, regular communication in plain English is all that's required. For you to make known what your request is at a time that the judge has the ability to do something about it. There is absolutely no question that this judge knew that I wanted the family in. He starts the whole inquiry, this whole exchange starts with him saying, it's my understanding that that's what you want. Then we have the litany that follows that. But he indicates that he has that understanding. After we have that discussion about he's going to allow me to bring him in and so forth, then I tell him, yeah, that's fine. We'll follow that procedure for that purpose, but I still object. Okay? I still object because you're still not letting me have what you know and have said you understand is my request. How can we say that he did not understand the basis of my objection? He indicated himself that he understood it. And that's all that's required, to let him know what the request is in a way that he can do it at a time that he has the ability to do so. And that's what we did. As to waivability, you know, the cases that are cited by the state, the Levine case is a contempt issue, and there was no request that the courtroom be open. There was no objection to any particular person be excluded from the courtroom. In HIT, the United States versus HIT, there was no objections to anybody being excluded from the courtroom. And I assume that based on the language that is contained in HIT from the Fifth Circuit, that they believe that you can waive that if you don't make an objection. But there was an objection in this case, and so I don't believe that it's waived. I also wanted to address very briefly the comments that counsel made in regard to the 403 discussion. She indicates that there's no argument in the brief regarding the application of the 403 balancing test of the facts in this case, their specific argument that the need for the evidence is the reason that we felt like the 403 balancing that the court did was inappropriate. That because of the way that the state went about doing this, they had their cake and they ate it too, because they not only were allowed to elicit from Mr. Castillo his testimony that he had never seen the man be violent, then we're cut off from being able to respond to that. They take me to task for not objecting to Mr. Castillo's testimony at the time that it came in. What was the proper objection? There was no objection. That was at issue. Who was the first aggressor? What was his propensity to violence? Was that issue? And so I could not, there was not a legitimate objection that would allow me to keep Castillo's testimony out at that point. That's the reason when I come back and say, okay, if you're going to cut me off and not allow me to rebut this testimony, strike it. Go back and strike it. Because it allows the state to leave a false impression with the jury. It allows the state to present something that they knew was incorrect. And we don't do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Thank you, Ms. Faulkner. Mr. Butcher, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is now submitted. We will take a recess and for a panel change and our 10:30 docket, which is one case, Bradshaw versus Sykes.
All right.